From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Cannes Film Festival is underway in the south of France. Among the few U.S. titles in competition is Spike Lee's Black Klansman. We'll find out what more to expect. Then, with rock and roll bands no longer headlining Coachella or topping the charts, is rock and roll finally dead?
What we define rock to be has to be malleable. You know, it's not one thing. It's not classic rock, which I think is what we generally associate it with.
And how Drew Drogi got a stage career by way of viral videos. All that coming right up. The Cannes Film Festival just started in the south of France. The opening night movie was Everybody Knows, starring Javier Bardem and Penelope Cruz. The film is written and directed by the Iranian filmmaker Asghar Farhadi. His film, A Separation, won the foreign language Oscar 6 years ago. And his film reflects both the global nature of Cannes and its love of auteur and usually male directors. But that's not all that Cannes is known for. Hollywood uses it as a marketing platform to launch global movies. Case in point, Solo, a Star Wars movie, will be there, playing outside of the festival's competition. And those all-night yacht parties, they are for real. Before he hopped on a plane for France, Kyle Buchanan visited The Frame to talk about what he's expecting at the festival. He's a senior editor for Vulture.
There's nothing normal about Cannes. You are in the south of France on the beach, going to yacht parties, wearing tuxedos. You feel like a secret agent at all times. It's just the most sort of absurd as far as wealth and glamour and all of that goes. But then also the movies that you see, they tend to come from sort of the most acclaimed high holy directors in cinema. So it's this really interesting sort of merging of the ascetic and the aesthetic.
Wow, well said. Now,
I'm going to copyright that.
There are certain categories within Cannes, but most people talk about the competition, which is where all the prizes are handed out. Are there some competition films that you are looking forward to?
Yeah, the two American films in competition this year are probably two of my most anticipated. There's Under the Silver Lake. It's by the director of It Follows, a big horror hit recently. And it's a noir film set in sunny Silver Lake, John, a neighborhood we both know well, starring Andrew Garfield. And then the other American film I'm looking forward to in comp is Spike Lee's Black Klansman, which is exactly what the title sounds like. It is based on a true story about a black man who went undercover in the Ku Klux Klan, which is something you can do when you've got those hoods on, I suppose.
That's probably true. There are a couple prominent directors who are back at Cannes. I'm going to ask you first about Lars von Trier. He's the director of Melancholia and Antichrist. He was returning to Cannes since he was banned in 2011. When he said this about Adolf Hitler, he's not what you would call a good guy, but yeah, I understand much about him and I sympathize with him a little bit. So what feel-good movie is Lars von Trier bringing back to Cannes?
I mean, you're right. That was probably the most notorious Cannes press conference ever. Not just because Lars seemed to go off the rails, but because Kirsten Dunst's responses to that, her uh-oh, we're in hot water now faces, make perfect gifts. But he is back at the film festival with a film called The House That Jack Built. It's with Matt Dillon and Uma Thurman, and it is about a serial killer. So he's not shying away from what is provocative, and I think it'll be interesting to see how he's received at Cannes. He says that personally he's turned over a new leaf, that he's sober, but that press conference will be the most highly anticipated, it's safe to say.
And there's another filmmaker who is a polarizing figure, and that's Gaspar Noé. He made a graphic movie about rape called Irreversible. He has a new film called Climax. I suspect it's not musical comedy.
No, I'll be curious to see it. Again, this is someone who does not shy away from the literally pornographic in his work. The last movie I saw of his at Cannes was called Love. And what I'll say about Love is that if he hadn't used the title Climax for this film, he could have used it numerous times in that film.
Do you think there's going to be a discernible difference in the air around Cannes in the post-Harvey Weinstein Me Too movement? Do you think, I think it certainly was palpable at Sundance. Harvey wasn't quite as big a presence at Cannes as he has been at Sundance. But do you think there'll be a discernible difference? And also, are women directors, which Cannes has historically not been kind to, Are they being welcomed into some of the competition slots?
I think Cannes has a lot of room to make up in that regard. One of the perils of having this festival that tends to lean heavily on veteran, older, respected auteurs is that you sometimes are not the vanguard of what is new and what is going on. And because there aren't as many female filmmakers at the level of, you know, a Godard or, you know, past Cannes competitors like the Coen brothers, then a lot of the times they are mostly shut out from competition. Or the director of the festival, Terry Frémaux, is not taking the steps to encourage the sort of younger, new female talent, and he's relegating them to sidebars when they're honestly deserving of a promotion. So I think that we will be thinking, I mean, it's impossible not to think about gender issues at Cannes. You know, this is the festival that, for the past few years, one of the main controversies has been whether women are allowed to or forced to wear high heels on the red carpet. You know, I think that France...
Because somebody didn't and was told to change her shoes.
Yeah, was told that they couldn't enter. France, when it comes to the Me Too movement, it's a tricky, thorny situation. And I think it really gets at the heart of how France regards gender, the French regard gender. And on the one hand, it's empowering. And then on the other hand, it's still rooted in a whole lot of sexual appeal towards men, the way that women are seen in that society. And so a lot of French actresses have been sending, let's say, to be generous, mixed signals regarding the Me Too movement. So it'll be interesting to see. But I do think that whether or not the competition lineup reflects sort of today's society and women and people of color, the juries do. And so, you know, you have a jury that's led this year by Cate Blanchett that has people like Ava DuVernay and Kristen Stewart on it. So I'm excited to see what they choose from the films that are in competition.
Kyle, have a great trip.
I'll try.
Or should I say bon voyage?
You can say it. It's
bon
fine.
Voyage, Kyle.
Merci.
That is the sum total of our French. Kyle Buchanan is a senior editor at Vulture. Kyle, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Take one look at the Billboard Top 40 charts or the most popular artists on Spotify, and one thing is for sure, and that is rock and roll just isn't very popular these days, at least as rock and roll has been defined in the past. The Coachella Festival in its early years was dominated by indie rock bands, but this year's Beyoncé's headlining performance was all that anyone could talk about. Add to that the recent bankruptcy by guitar maker Gibson, and you've got some music journalists talking once again about the death of rock and roll. Last weekend, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inducted Bon Jovi, The Cars, Dire Straits, The Moody Blues, Nina Simone, and Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Not exactly all rock and rollers, are they? To talk more about rock's current state and its future, I'm joined by Shirley Halperin, executive music editor for Variety, and Roy Traken, a pop culture critic. And to start, I asked Traken to give us his thoughts on what this year's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame class says about the state of rock.
I think we're sort of getting to the bottom of the barrel in terms of the, especially the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. You know, best example of this fact is that, you know, this year's batch is headlined by Jon Bon Jovi. And he is someone that has the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has resisted inducting him for years and years and years, despite a certain amount of support within the nominating committee, of which I was a part, and I saw the arguments for John. But I think at this point, and Moody Blues among the 60s acts is coming in, and then you've got, you know, Sister Rosetta Tharpe and Nina Simone, and these acts are sort of peripherally rock and roll. So it just shows you the state of what is called rock and roll at this point. There are a lot of different sorts of opinions.
Well, if we were to look at what audiences and record buyers and music listeners are doing, What does that say about the state of rock and roll? What do the charts tell us about where things are going?
So it's interesting. I mean, there are certain formats where rock continues to thrive, like the album format. It is the number one genre for someone who is going to buy a full album, even though on the song consumption side of things, it's rap and hip hop. But rock still comes in number two. And I think it's because rock has a very wide sort of palette. And many kinds of pop-leaning acts can be considered rock in their own way. We just had Pete Wentz from Fall Out Boy write an essay for Variety about what does rock mean today. And what he was saying was basically that what we define rock to be has to be malleable. You know, it's not one thing. It's not classic rock, which I think is what we generally associate it with.
And Roy?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I just had a conversation with John Landau recently, who's a very important member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the nominating committee. And he said what he's looking for in terms of inducting acts is what Berry Gordy called the sound of young America, which could be anything. I mean, it could be rock and roll, it could be soul, it could be hip hop. But if you're talking about traditional rock, guitar, bass, drums, I think that is evolving into something else right now.
How much are the economics of the music business driving this? Because it used to be that you could make money just playing music. And now it's all about the merch and the ticket sales when you're touring. Does that favor a certain kind of act? And does that mean that if you don't choose wisely, you're not going to be able to succeed and make a living playing music if you're not in a category that's going to do a lot of big ticket sales and sell a lot of merch?
Yeah, I think it's like you almost have to want to be a legacy act, because those legacy acts or heritage acts are the ones who do gangbusters on the road. In fact, I heard from a concert industry insider once that the way that they judge the summer concert season is based upon how many stadium shows Def Leppard has booked. If it's like 12 to 14 in a summer, it's a good season. If it's 7 or 8, it's not so great. So it's like Def Leppard, who haven't had a hit since, you know, the 90s probably, you know, continue to tour and sell out stadiums. And that tells you that the rock heritage market is still incredibly vibrant and people are buying the tickets and they are buying the merch. And most importantly, they're buying sodas, they're buying hamburgers,
right.
They're paying
they're
for
doing
parking.
Concessions, yes.
Yeah, that's how the music industry makes its money. So again, it's like one of these things where I want to say that there's a silo of rock that's doing really well, but it's bigger than that on the road. It really commands the road.
Right. It's still a major attraction, certainly. And Shirley, you pointed out Def Leppard. They are touring with Journey right now, and it's a huge success. It's selling out everywhere. It's selling out 18,000-seat arenas, which is incredible, considering Journey doesn't even have their original lead singer.
Right.
But the question is, how is it going to evolve? And are we going to have these holograms? Are we going to have symphony orchestras playing the music of Led Zeppelin? How is this music going to be preserved? You know, we've already seen what the Eagles are doing,
yes,
replacing members with second generation.
That's
it's
right.
A corporation, and
yep,
these brands, it's brands more than bands.
Yes.
And these brands will exist even when the members themselves start to knock off,
yes,
as we've seen.
We're talking with Shirley Halperin, executive editor for music at Variety, and pop culture critic Roy Trakin, who writes for Variety. Roy, I want to ask you about a band named Greta Van Fleet. This is the song Highway Tune. So I could be catty and say it sounds like discount Robert Plant, but I won't. Tell me about Greta Van Fleet and why you like it.
They're proud of that legacy, and they don't deny it. And, you know, they embrace the term the next Led Zeppelin. And, you know, these are kids, they're barely out of their 20s, and they're steeped in this music. It comes to them, honestly. They're not putting anything on. This is the way they sound. They come from a small town in Michigan. And, you know, that's the hope for the next generation, that they go forward, but also look back at what brought them there, just as the rock in the 60s did.
So Shirley, that's a really interesting idea. The whole idea of being derivative yet original at the same time. When you think about the rock bands that maybe you saw at Coachella, did you start thinking about that? Like, who is original and who reminds me of somebody I've heard before? And did some bands stick out as actually being unique in that they have a new sound and a new style.
Well, there are very few rock acts at Coachella this year, so that might not be the good example. But I will say that, you know, as someone who covers the pop charts pretty fanatically at Variety, every couple of years you have a Portugal the Man or even a Gautier pop up who are essentially indie artists, and they manage to cross over. Now, you know, more times than not, it ends up just being a one hit and out kind of thing. But I think its influence carries, you know, and brings out these different sounds that you're referring to, whether it's synthesizers or drum machines or whatever. There might not even be a guitar, but it still feels like a rock band.
Let's listen to a little bit of Portugal the Man. So, Roy, you did a piece where you talked to the frontman for Portugal the Man. His name is not Portugal. It's John Gurley. And he said, and I'm quoting him now, rock and roll is very shook right now. It's too formalized with its own rules and regulations. You just can't be a rock star by rehashing things you've seen or done before. Bring something new, which is what hip hop does best. What is he onto there?
You know, anything that kind of, you know, smacks of rock and roll and white rock and roll in particular is almost like uncool right now.
Right.
It's, you know, rock and roll is just the big band swing or the jazz, you know, of a previous generation. It's been commodified and put in a niche and, you know, has its formalistic qualities that, you know, maybe some are tweaking these days, but not enough.
Something else is happening, and that is that a generation of people, I think we can agree, were rockers, are no longer with us. David Bowie, Chuck Berry, Tom Petty. What does that suggest in terms of, you know, who is no longer with us and the people who are hanging on playing the music that is probably associated with that era?
I mean, the thing that I find saddest beyond just the fact that these people are no longer with us is that people won't be able to see them play guitar.
Right.
Like, you know, Tom Petty. And I think we're seeing like Gibson, you know, going through bankruptcy right now. That makes me fear even more for the, you know, life of the guitar. Like they just won't be able to see that and that tremendous talent, which got so many people hooked onto rock music in the first place with their own eyes. And that I think is really sad.
Yeah, it's certainly collateral damage, isn't it? And I mean, when you talk about rock and roll, as I say, you talk about guitar, bass, drums. That's, you know, I mean, that sort of defines what it came out of. But again, if you look at the history of popular music, the instruments change, the modes of distribution change, the sounds change, the idea of rhythm changes, nothing stays the same. And so in terms of making a living at it and making a dent, yeah, it becomes a little more difficult. And you have to think about a little more than just the music itself, because it's a whole ecosystem to build.
Shirley and Roy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Shirley Halperin is executive music editor at Variety, and Roy Trakin is a pop culture critic at Variety. Los Angeles is a magnet for dreamers. The city is full of people who left their small towns and big cities around the world hoping to make it big in the entertainment business. One of those dreamers is Drew Droege, an actor and comedian who also teaches at the Groundling School. Currently, Droege is starring in the play Die, Mommy, Die, which opens this week at the Kirk Douglas Theater. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving recently caught up with him before an afternoon rehearsal to find out more about his path to this point in his career.
Hello, my name is Drew Droege. I always wanted to be a really like dramatic actor. I really resented getting laughs on stage for the longest time, and I would be in acting class doing like Hedda Gabler or something that I was awful at, and I would get bigger and more dramatic. Like, and I would get laughs and I would be so mad because I wanted to be taken seriously. And then I realized that I come from a funny family. I only watched Carol Burnett and In Living Color and SNL growing up, and it's really what I should be doing. And then I realized like the way to be funny is to just be as serious as you could be. And then that's sort of what leads to doing Die Mommy Die, which is just so dramatic, but it has to be so committed and played like drama, even though it's the most ridiculous comedy on earth.
Forgive my appearance. I've been up to my elbows in manure.
Droege is reprising his role as Angela Arden, a grand old Hollywood dame who murders her husband. He first performed Die, Mommy, Die at the LGBTQ-centric Celebration Theater last year. Both productions were directed by Ryan Bergman.
In Die, Mommy, Die, he is a woman. So this isn't a drag show at all. And I didn't direct it that way. I directed Drew as if he was a glamorous female former movie star, not as, you know, this man playing a woman. And so his ability to wrap his mind around any character in that way, no matter that character's flaws or gifts or sexuality or, you know, sex, period, is pretty amazing to me.
I have it on excellent authority, by way of every hair burner in West Hollywood, that the favors you've received were not only courtesy of the ladies, but les garçons as well.
I am from Lincolnton, North Carolina. On its website, it says it's on the quiet side of Charlotte, which has always made me laugh because Charlotte is such a banging, loud, violent cesspool of filth, apparently, according to the Lincolnton website. I had a wild imagination. I was bored a lot, so I always wanted to be kidnapped. And I dreamed of like a Pinocchio life, of like joining a circus or, you know. And I didn't understand like, oh, there are donkeys and Candyland's really terrible. Like in my mind, it all looked great.
Eat all you can. Be a glutton. Stuff yourselves. It's all free, boys. It's all free.
I started doing community theater when I was in high school. And the first real like play I got to do was The Diary of Anne Frank. I was just like through the moon excited when I got to do that. But I never thought I could do that for a living. But I spent a summer in London doing the Shakespeare program at RADA. And I just met other professional actors and I was like, oh, you can actually do this with your life. And then when I was visiting LA before I moved here, I saw a show at the Groundlings Theater and it was exactly what I wanted to do. My family thought I was crazy because I'm the quiet one in my family.
I write for the New York Observer. You probably remember my film work in the 70s. I was in a very important film called Myra Breckinridge. Thank you.
It's so crazy because I so imagined LA to be everything you see in the movies, where it's just like all the parties and everybody knowing each other. And I had this fantasy of being like immediately whisked away into this like, you know, dream, weird cartoon idea of what it was. But the best thing for me was when that kind of got quickly brushed away. I know for a lot of people that's like, it shatters some sort of illusion. But for me, I was like, when I was seeing people working in so many different ways in the business, it sort of demystified it for me.
After getting settled in LA and a failed attempt to get cast on Saturday Night Live, Droege happened into what became a life changer for him.
Good evening, America. I'm Chloe Sevigny.
I was doing a sketch comedy show and I put on a blonde wig for something else we were doing. And I looked in the mirror and I was like, I look like Chloe Sevigny. And then what do you do with that? But then I read an interview with Chloe Sevigny and she was name dropping all of these hyper specific references, and her world was like a Bret Easton Ellis novel, and it was so interesting and fascinating.
Molecular gastronomy, which has given birth to spherical olives, drinkable popcorn, frozen Gruyere air, coconut soil, and gelled fox meat.
I did a solo piece in the sketch show as Chloe, and it bombed horribly. I didn't get a single laugh. It was one of the most embarrassing things I've ever done on stage. And then my friend Jim Hansen was really on me for like 6 months to make videos as Chloe because he saw it in his head. And I didn't want to do that. And I was like, I'm not a drag queen and I don't really want to do all that stuff. And he sat on me until we did it and we finally made them. And then they were up for several months until one day out of the blue, they blew up and they've become, you know, to this day, the biggest thing I've ever done.
Last year, Drew Droege wrote and starred in the one-man play Bright Colors and Bold Patterns, which started at an indie theater in Los Angeles, then had a successful run off Broadway. He appears in the upcoming TV series based on the cult classic 80s comedy Heathers.
It's such an impossible business to figure out, and everyone has a different story, and everyone does it differently. So when people ask for advice, you know, I would have no idea what to say to people other than make your own stuff. You can't will someone to like you and to hire you. And you can't sit around bitter and say, I could have been a contender. Like, who cares? Get out of your own way and do it.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
Die, Mommy, Die, starring Drew Drogi, runs from May 10th to the 20th at the Kirk Douglas Theater in Culver City. And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. You will find us at The Frame. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow.